Hi, welcome to the Wellness Doctors Podcast with Dr. Lorena
and Dr. Vanessa.
We are both medical doctors who talk about how to optimize health and well-being so that you can be empowered to make better healthy choices, enrich the lives of people around you, and join us in the evolution of healthcare.
Hi everyone, it's Vanessa here, and today we also have Lorena. Hi Lorena.
Hi, Vanessa, everyone.
Hi, and today we have a guest from Hong Kong. So welcome, Amy.
Welcome. Hi, Vanessa and Lorena. Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. It's an honor that you're coming on.
Pleasure.
Yeah. So we met Amy through the Dutch hormone workshop. Is that right?
That's right.
We also got together in Hong Kong. Yeah. So since then, Amy and I have worked together in her nutritional course. And so to start off with, let me give a bio of Amy so everybody knows where Amy's background is from. So Amy Lamotte is the Managing Director of Valot Nutrigenomics Limited in Hong Kong. She's a clinical nutritionist and researcher specializing in personalized nutrition, nutritional biochemistry, and nutritional genomics. Her other areas of interest include nutrition for anti-aging, circadian biology, and the microbiome. She also serves as a clinical advisor to Oxford HealthSpan Limited. She has a Master's of Science in Human Nutrition from the University of Bridgeport and a JD from Yale Law School. Wow, Amy, so that is two careers.
Yay!
Yeah. So my story, my transition from being a lawyer to a nutritionist is kind of a long one because it actually starts back when I was 18 years old. So when I was 18, I went to work as a summer job in Vermont. And one day I woke up and my neck was completely swollen. And at the time, you know, I had no idea what that was. But of course, now I know that I had a goiter. And I was basically told, okay, you don't live in Vermont. When you go back to college, go see your doctor, see what they say. And so when I went back to university, I went to see the doctors and I think they ran some testing and they said, you're fine. And by that time, the goiter had disappeared. They said, everything's fine. Not to worry. Just go back to your life as normal. And that's what I did. And I graduated from college. I went into law school. I became a lawyer. And I guess my biggest signs and symptoms during that time period were just very low energy. So unlike most college students who would be out partying or having fun, I was either sleeping or studying. That's what I was doing. But I did manage to graduate from college, to graduate from law school. And the straw that really broke the camel's back for me was when I went to work as a corporate lawyer. So I was working in New York City. I was, you know, working crazy hours. I never saw the sunshine. I was eating all of my food as takeaway food. And there was a high level of stress. And, you know, after a certain time period, I was just really burnt out. And I didn't really understand at the time, you know, why can I not deal with this when it seemed like so many of my colleagues had no problem dealing with this high level of stress and this existence. But I didn't go see a doctor because I just thought it was normal. It was my normal at the time.
Mm-hmm. So roughly what age were you at this time?
So that was in my late 20s, early 30s.
So you've, from the first goiter, it's been over a decade, and you've just been struggling with these sort of subclinical symptoms all this time, and it was just sheer willpower that drove you through all of it.
Yeah. And then, you know, and then I had, it was after my second child that I went to see my doctor, and she not only as a GP, but she also has a master's of science in endocrinology. And she's very interested in hormones. And she was like, I think maybe we should test you for a thyroid and see what happens. And this is the first time, you know, 18 years later, essentially, the first time anyone had mentioned the word thyroid. And sure enough, she tested me. And not only did I have hypothyroid, but I also had antibodies. So I had Hashimoto's disease.
I'm surprised they didn't test out your first pregnancy.
Yes, that is somewhat surprising. Is that standard of care now that they test every woman for thyroid before pregnancy?
Not really. No, it's not standard. No.
It's kind of weird, but no, it's not.
So that for me was kind of when the work actually began, because getting the diagnosis was sort of half of the struggle. And at the time, at least, I think the strategy was still, well, you know, sorry, you're not making thyroid. You have to take thyroid medication for the rest of your life. And there's not a lot more that we can do for you. But I guess because of my background, because of my law degree, I wasn't really satisfied with that answer. And so I was like, well, I'm just going to start educating myself. You know, what is this? Is there anything I can do? So I started reading books, and then I started reading articles, and then, you know, more and more. I think for me, a turning point was when I discovered the work of Ben Lynch, and I got very interested in nutritional genomics. And ironically, I think there's something not dissimilar to law and the type of analysis you do in law and biochemistry. There's kind of an overlap there to the type of thinking that it requires. And that was really the hook for me. Like, I really enjoyed it. I thought it was interesting. But I still hadn't decided to do a master's degree yet. And when I was on my way to see my brother-in-law in the Hamptons, I happened to be listening to this podcast on Bulletproof Radio. And it was a podcast interview of Dr. Sid Baker. Do either of you know him?
Yeah.
So he is like a founding father of the whole functional medicine movement. And I had never heard of him at the time. And so I'm Googling him and I'm looking him up, and it's like, he's based in Sag Harbor, which is right where I was. I was like, this is so strange. This is a sign. So I call him up and I go to see him. And it was amazing to meet him, first of all, because he is, you know, founder of the functional medicine movement. But he was the one who really said to me, Amy, you know, if you're interested in this area, you don't go study genetics. You need to study epigenetics, and you need to get your master's of science in nutrition. And that's what I did. It was like weeks later from having that conversation, I was enrolled in the master's of science program at Bridgeport.
And now you're done. You've graduated.
Now I'm done. I've graduated. And I guess the key is, you know, in doing all of that, I reversed my own autoimmune condition. And so I really wanted to have that knowledge to be able to help people do the same.
That's a great story.
So when you actually had the thyroid test through your endocrinologist, did they also test for the antibodies? Because often when thyroid function testing is done conventionally, most doctors don't necessarily also like test for the antibodies as well. It's often just the two hormones, like the TSH and the T4, that's standard. Regardless of whether we're in Hong Kong or Australia, because that's basically what my colleagues do, and very rarely do they test for the antibody. So yours was tested by your endocrinologist, and they found that you had antibodies.
So mine was tested early on, and I did find that I had antibodies, and I did do a thyroid scan as well. So that was, you know, that was all good. It's just that, you know, I was kind of told, well, there's nothing you can do about it.
So we haven't really covered much thyroid on our podcast, so maybe Amy's the perfect person to ask. Can you give like a broad overview of what are the common problems that can go wrong with a thyroid, and, you know, why is it particularly more so with women? Why is it more so with, you know, before and after pregnancies and all these things? How is that all connected?
Well, as you two know, the thyroid, it plays such a central role in everything, you know, in energy metabolism, in digestion, in hormones, that many things I think can go wrong if you have hypothyroidism. And in my case, you know, like I said, the main symptoms were energy metabolism, but if I look back now, I know that there were probably digestive issues there. And I think that's a key takeaway, because often when I work with clients now, their initial answer will be, I don't have any digestive issues. No, I don't have anything. And you dig a little deeper and then you realize, oh, actually there are problems with the digestive system at the same time.
Or maybe they just had it for so long. That's their norm. So they don't think that it's a problem because it's been served for years.
I think that's true.
And often people don't actually associate the different patterns that we often see in their history. So I think it's also one of the challenges for most people if they're not necessarily looking or curious about getting to the bottom of the issue. They often just take the medication and then that's fine. They're done with it. Then they don't often put two and two together because there's not that sort of training involved. So when you go through the the deeper learning, I think that's where you start to see that, yes, there are these ties and patterns that can go back like 10, 20 years, which is often the case that I see in practice as well, is that there were some signs at the time. The body was able to take care of it. It healed, but then there were other stresses. And then it sort of was like yourself, the straw on the camel's back.
And I think one of the amazing things is that you can use nutrition in a relatively short window to reverse the antibody attack. So, yeah. You know, the second step would be, okay, can you regenerate the thyroid? And I'm not sure we know how to do that yet, but at least stopping the antibody attack, you can do it relatively quickly. And most people don't know this.
I think sometimes I have to explain to patients that, okay, your GP or your endocrinologist has told you, okay, the diagnosis is low thyroid, a hypothyroid. So you take a supplement. But what they don't explain is that the underlying autoimmunity is still ongoing. You're just masking over the symptoms by giving these supplemental hormones. So what happens is you keep attacking and burning off your thyroid until there isn't any functional tissue. And so, yes, you have to take thyroid hormones for the rest of your life. But in a conventional management model, that's actually the way forward. Like that's how they manage. So to a conventional doctor, maybe it isn't worth knowing what the numbers for those antibodies are because it doesn't change management plan. So they're not as interested in knowing whether you have a high antibody load or low antibody load, whether you've burnt off your thyroid hormones or not. So knowing it is important because if you keep a tab on how your antibodies are responding, you have an idea of whether the nutrition changes you've made or lifestyle changes you've made have made a difference because your thyroid number wouldn't change that much because you're propping it up with an exogenous hormone, right? So that's the only marker you really have. So could you explain a little bit why nutrition can affect our immune system and therefore affect the antibodies level?
So when I work with clients, we use the 5R framework. And I would say it's not a protocol because everyone has a different outcome on it. And it looks different for each person because we personalize it. But it is a helpful framework. And with that framework, you can try to restore immune tolerance. So you stopping the autoimmune attack, you're getting rid of the inflammation, which is really key. And you're repairing the digestive system all at the same time. So, you know, the foundation for me as the nutritionist is the elimination diet. So 5R, I don't know if you've discussed this with your podcast before, but you're looking at remove, which is the elimination diet in many cases, replace, which is replacing digestive enzymes or stomach acid, reinoculate, which is probiotics and prebiotics, repair, which is the intestinal lining, and rebalance, which is often dealing with stress and lifestyle changes.
So is it that the foods we eat somehow triggers our immune system and therefore it attacks us? Do we have any evidence of certain types of food doing this?
Well, I think, you know, the framework for how autoimmune conditions work, and this applies not only to thyroid conditions, but comes from celiac disease. So we know often that there is a genetic predisposition. There is some form of GI dysfunction, especially intestinal permeability. And then you have an environmental trigger, and that trigger could be different. But in celiac disease, obviously that trigger is going to be gluten. And I find also in thyroid conditions that gluten is often a food that not only you want to eliminate during the elimination diet period, but many people choose to continue to eliminate that, you know, for the rest of their lives, potentially.
Okay. And I think there are some overlap between the genetics of Hashimoto's and other kinds of thyroid problems and celiac. So if you do have a family member with celiac or any other type of autoimmune conditions, you potentially may be more vulnerable to a lot of these external attacks from foods and the anti-allergens. And so going through an elimination diet will help you decide if certain types of food are problematic for you and whether to reintroduce certain types of food at a later stage when you've healed your
Yeah, life. I think that's a really good point. And a lot of people don't have their genetics available. But as you said, just looking at your personal family history can give you a lot of clues. Like in my case, my great-grandmother had colitis. My father and his sister both have Crohn's disease. Like, we have a very strong autoimmune family predisposition, unfortunately. And I don't need, you know, my genetics to do that. Obviously, genetics are helpful. But just looking at your family history can really provide clues.
Yeah, and often do you find that when we go through like a medical questionnaire and we ask for family history and you see a pattern of things like rheumatoid arthritis, which is also another autoimmune condition, or lupus, systemic lupus, erythematosus, which is another autoimmune one. And then sometimes they may also mention something like Sjogren's, which often presents with dry eyes. You start to see this pattern. And so when you have that particular patient in front of you, it's almost as if an alarm bell goes off and you think, well, I need to consider it, and perhaps this person has an underlying autoimmune issue. Because I think one of the things about the immune system is that it's so complex. And why is it that so some people have the genetics, but they never suffer from the condition? So, you know, that's also something which our genes and our environment has that interaction. We can actually change expression of our bodies just because of the choices that we make.
And I think this is where what you mentioned about intestinal permeability, or also known as leaky gut, comes into play. Right, because you can eat foods as long as they don't get into our bloodstream and the immune system doesn't recognize it as a threat, you can still potentially eat it without any problems. But if your gut is leaky, it's not able to protect you from certain things. So it's not to say that, oh my God, I had this diagnosis, I would never ever be able to eat any of these foods again. It's just a process of, okay, let's work out through the 5-hour you mentioned, how does the gut play into all this and how does it work for us as opposed to
I think that's
us?
A really good point. And in my, you know, in my clinical practice, the goal is really to find the most nutrient-dense diet that's not causing inflammation. So normally we'll do an elimination for 3 weeks. I find that people can usually do 3 weeks. If it's more than 3 weeks, people are not compliant. And if it's less than 3 weeks, you might not get the information that you need. But the goal is not to stay on this elimination diet for the rest of your life or to have this highly restricted diet. The goal is to reintroduce as many foods as you can without causing inflammation, because many of these foods are really good for the microbiome. Many of these foods have phytonutrients that we need. I mean, you want to have as most diverse of a diet as you can.
Because you mentioned something about immune tolerance. And it's something that we all have. It's an ability to tolerate things that are our own tissue. You know, otherwise all of us would be rejecting our skin, our hearts, our livers, our spleens, our pancreas. So we're born with this ability to recognize what is part of us and what is foreign. So when we start to lose that tolerance, then that's where a lot of the mistakes are made in the immune system. So there's an underlying genetic component to how well we get triggered or how severely we get triggered. So what you're saying is correct, is that even though we've eliminated maybe sort of that straw on the camel's back, but how do we then restore that tolerance? Because we were born with it, we developed it. So I think the question is, what are the things that can create a loss of tolerance? And then what are the components that can restore it for us through nutrition and diet?
I think you're talking about environmental triggers. And in my case, what was interesting was that I had mono several months before this happened. So in my case, you know, the trigger was likely the infection. But, you know, a lot of people who have thyroid conditions have issues with toxins or heavy metals. That can often be an issue. I remember early on, when I was still seeing the endocrinologist and I had done my first detox, and he looked at my numbers before and after, and he's like, I don't know what you're doing, but something is changing, you know, changing how you're doing this. And I'm like, well, do you want to hear, you know, I'm doing this detox? And I'm like, oh, no, not really, you know, but clearly that, you know, that was helpful as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think another interesting phenomenon I find is when women become pregnant, some of the allergies or the immune conditions seems to be suppressed or seems to go away completely. So their stuffy noses go away, their eczema is improved. And part of it is because when you're pregnant, you're having to tolerate DNA that is not from you. It's from your partner or the father of the child. So instead of rejecting the baby because it's not you, fully you, you have to suppress your immune system to be able to let the fetus grow. And so a lot of this immune tolerance seems to be improved whilst you're pregnant. But then after the baby's delivered, then your hormones, A, are all over the shop, and B, your immune system is having to reestablish a balance. And a lot of the times that's what triggers some women into having some autoimmune conditions as well. Do you see that in
I
your
do see that in
practices?
practice. And as you know, kind of the low-hanging fruit in any kind of autoimmune disease is to look at vitamin D levels, because vitamin D is so important in maintaining immune tolerance that you want to make sure your patient or your client has adequate vitamin D levels. And I have not had a person yet who's come into my practice who has a vitamin D at baseline over 40. So I'm still waiting for that person who, knows about, because it's known now, so well known about.
They're probably supplementing. The ones who do come in with a level that's actually over 40 probably know about it. And they're already
But
on a
so few people, I
supplement
think a
or
lot
they're
of people are supplementing and they still don't
very few.
test. They think that just because they're supplementing, they're going to have enough. And sometimes that's not enough. And genetics impact that and other things impact that. But
Yep, completely. Yeah, agree.
Even if you're more inflamed, it actually takes out the vitamin D. So that you don't see the level that we measure in the blood seems lower, but actually it's been sucked up to be used somewhere else because you're inflamed. So it's all a very dynamic balance with vitamin D. And with COVID and everything, I'm seeing a lot of studies on vitamin D as well in terms of protecting or tampering the course of COVID. They're looking at, people at baseline, whether they had enough vitamin D or not, and their outcomes are actually very significantly different. So you were mentioning about how to get a nutrient-rich diet for people with autoimmune or gut conditions without, but still be able to do the elimination. So do you have any tips on how someone could do it with, for example, their vegetarians, or they have more of an Asian palate, or they have certain types of allergies like seafood. How do you manage all these diets, and what are any tips we can take away from it?
That's where personalizing is really important. So in my practice, and I'm sure in your practice, we all practice evidence-based medicine, in your case, nutrition, in my case. So not only are we looking at the research, or we're looking at the clinical practice, but our clinical experience, but we're looking at the patient's values and preferences. And that's a really important part. So if someone is vegetarian, I might have to say, okay, what is your experience with eggs, for example? And they'll say, eggs are great. I eat eggs all the time. I don't have any problems with eggs. And that is a food we would normally eliminate. But for a vegetarian, I might say, okay, well, let's trust that. Let's let them keep the eggs, because otherwise, what are they going to have for protein? So we're personalizing in that sense. I work with a lot of Indian clients, actually, asking them to eliminate legumes, which is one of the highest lectin foods there is often not possible with their lifestyle. They don't want to eliminate legumes. So then we say, okay, let's pressure cook them, or let's learn how to prepare some of these foods so we lower the lectin content and we reduce the risk that it's going to cause inflammation. So with some of these higher lectin foods, that often involves a more traditional way of preparing them, soaking them, sprouting them, peeling them, deseeding them, cooking them.
So, what's the problem with lectins for people who have an autoimmune
Gluten is
condition?
a lectin. If you have intestinal permeability, it can often trigger an autoimmune response.
Yeah, so
Yeah.
you mentioned lectin in legumes. So, lectins are sort of these anti-nutrients that plants have as a defense mechanism, and at higher doses, it's somewhat toxic. so that animals that are trying to eat the plants don't overeat them, so they save a little bit of their seeds for the next generation. But in our gut, it could cause a little bit of inflammatory response. And for most people who don't have a problem with this, you'd barely notice. You know, you can eat your beans and you can eat the seeds and your cherry tomatoes, and it's not an issue. But for someone who's quite sensitive, they may need to lower that amount, because otherwise they're just adding fuel onto the flame and making their conditions worse. So, yeah, so lectins, another one. Anything else that you find that is problematic, commonly problematic for people with
autoimmune conditions? Dairy is a big one. And again, that's where I try to personalize it. So if someone says, you know, I can't live without dairy, then we'll look at dairy that it contains casein A2 instead of casein A1. That's sometimes less allergenic, more tolerable by people.
So is it possible to get the casein A2 milk here in Hong Kong? Because I know in Australia they have it. But
I don't know if you can get the cow's milk that's casein A2, but obviously goat milk, sheep's milk, any of these milks are going to be casein A2.
I've also seen in, you know, for example, in Australia, it says A2, but actually when you read into it, it's a mixture of A1 and A2. It's not full A2. So you kind of have to be careful with the labeling. Or if in doubt, switch to, you know, coconut milk or almond milk or rice milk or something.
Yeah. And with almonds, so, you know, often I tell my clients you want to soak them and peel them and make your own almond milk. And that is the best way to have almond milk that's not going to cause a reaction.
Yeah. And so there's also the other aspect of certain types of vegetable groups, like the nightshades, that are also in which some people, not all people with autoimmune conditions, but some do actually react to.
Yeah, we normally eliminate the nightshades unless there's a personalized reason not to. And sometimes you have to be careful with the squash family as well. So cucumbers, zucchini, different types of squash.
The thing is, when you start adding all these things together, it really restricts the diet to just meat and green leafy vegetables. And I think some people have been told you have to do it to the strictest possible way, and it sort of takes the joy out of living. And, you know, there comes a point when it's just not fun anymore, even though it seems to be helping with your lifestyle. So I think what you said about 3 weeks is reasonable. It just gives them a chance to feel any difference, right? And after that, you can add in a little bit of things. And what I find sometimes is that if I'm relaxed and I'm, you know, less stressed out and I'm sleeping well, I can actually tolerate more of the foods that are problematic for me. And when I'm more stressed, I need to be mindful that I don't overdo things like nuts or, you know, legumes. So people need to learn over time what foods are more problematic, but they can still tolerate a small amount if they're feeling good about themselves, and try and lead a normal life. Because most people don't just cook for themselves. They have to cook for the family. And that means making sure the kids get to eat what they want to eat and everybody gets to rotate.
And I have 3 kids. And so I'm familiar with that kind of lifestyle. So, you know, what will happen is, you know, we'll make some kind of meat sauce for a pasta, let's say, and I'll have it with cauliflower rice and everyone else will have it with pasta. And that works, right? That works. And I feel so well eliminating gluten that it's just something I've never reintroduced and probably will never reintroduce. And I do find with clients, like, they know after 3 weeks, they feel so much better eliminating certain foods. They usually continue on their own. It's not like they feel like they're being deprived. They feel so much better. They have so much more energy that it's changed their life. And they know, you know, how to go forward to have the best diet and lifestyle for themselves.
And it's important to help clients find that balance for themselves, as opposed to being told that they have to do it. It becomes a chore. They actually make a conscious decision that, you know what, I don't need gluten in my life because the payoff is so much better for me. Or if someone says, you know what, it's such a good piece of sourdough bread, even if potentially I get some problems tomorrow, I accept that as a payoff. And so I'm willing to enjoy it tonight with friends and family. So then you feel more in charge of your own health because you have power to control what the outcome is, more or less.
And you also mentioned a little bit about the sort of aspect of genetics and perhaps it's epigenetics that we're mentioning and how sort of lifestyle impacts on genes. When do you test for that in your practice? And also, if you do, what kind of circumstances would you do it? Do you do it routinely or do you just do it depending on
I tend not to overtest in my practice. Obviously, if someone comes to me with test results, I know how to interpret those. I don't think, especially for thyroid, I'm not sure that having genetics is that helpful, because doing the elimination diet is going to give you the most information, the most useful information, in my opinion. Even food allergy testing, I don't really do that. If someone comes to me with food allergy testing, of course, I look at it and I incorporate that information. I think for autoimmune conditions, the most helpful testing is stool testing.
Okay, and why is that? What are you gleaning
from this? Gleaning information that is going to help you personalize that 5-R program or protocol that we're talking about, framework. You are able to see how they are digesting their food. You know, do they have products of protein breakdown in their stool, which suggests they're not digesting their protein properly? Do they have enough pancreatic enzymes to digest their food? Are there markers of inflammation that suggest that maybe they even have inflammatory bowel disease? And you can look at whether they have, you know, what their microbiome actually looks like. I mean, obviously it's one test, it's one stool test. There's only so much information you're going to get from that, but it gives you a bit of a roadmap as to how to personalize their 5-R protocol.
And I want to mention the difference between a standard stool test and also the functional testing that you do, because often people come to us doctors and say, oh, you had a stool test, everything was clear. But really all they're looking for is whether or not they have parasites, whether or not they've got blood, occult blood in their stool, and whether or not they've got some type of virus. But it doesn't actually look at any of the digestive markers or the diversity of the gut flora. And so they're often missing a very key component to what you mentioned before in your 5-R program. And so it's very difficult to then say, you know, what's actually going on, because there definitely are markers that we look at in the functional test. So, for example, you probably know about secretory IgA, which is a really key component of the immune system in your mucous membranes. And so if I see that being really high or really low, it tells me either way whether this person has food intolerances or inflammation, or whether or not they actually need extra support in boosting the mucosal immune system. So it does actually make a difference as to which approach you're going to be focusing more on in the treatment. So I do definitely find, and I agree, that stool testing probably even more so than the food intolerance testing, because I get a lot of questions as to, food intolerance testing is really inaccurate. And in some ways, it's accurate for what you're looking for, but because the immune system is so diverse and there are so many different food intolerance tests that look for different aspects of the immune system, that no one is particularly the same. So, and I think that the cheapest way also is to actually do the elimination diet, because it is the gold standard and it is best practice and evidence-based. So I agree with trialing that first. And then looking at that. So yeah, thank you for sharing that.
The only thing that I think is useful in testing is probably some kind of inflammatory marker, like an hsCRP, because that shows you whether what you're doing is working. And you see that reversing over time with an elimination diet and with a more anti-inflammatory diet. And that's not an expensive test. So,
yeah. So what other nutrients would you advise people to focus on in terms of a thyroid condition? So for myself, I've had low-ish thyroid that isn't autoimmune. And I find that it happens when I'm more stressed or my body's been exposed to a lot of toxins and it suppresses my thyroid. I guess that's just genetically how I'm going to express stress. And I start losing hair, I start getting fatigued, I start putting on weight that isn't really weight. It just feels more like blubber. But consistently, I have not been tested for autoimmune. So for me, it's more stress management and making sure I get the nutrients to support my thyroid. So any tips on that?
I think, you know, selenium is really important because that is involved in the conversion of T4 to T3. And going back to the 5R, one of the things that is quite common in people who have hypothyroidism is low stomach acid. And if you have low stomach acid, you cannot break down your minerals as well. So selenium, zinc, iodine, obviously, we can look at. With iodine, I'm always very cautious. I'm not a doctor, so I don't want to supplement with iodine in clients unless they come to me and they can show me that their doctor has tested them and they're deficient, because excess iodine can cause autoimmune thyroid condition. But it's certainly something to look at and consider. Iron deficiency is another big one.
It's actually that's very, very common amongst women, because they often regular menses and loss of iron. And, you know, unfortunately, a lot of doctors still think that just because you're not anemic, you won't suffer from symptoms of iron deficiency. But actually you do, because you have all these subclinical symptoms that aren't really overt issues, but they do present as a subclinical thyroid problem. And so often when the test results show low normal, we need to start looking at what are the nutrients that this person could be deficient in. And low stomach acid is a really common one, I find, as well. And there are some telltale signs in clinic that I look at. So one of the things is I look for something called leukonychia. If you look at the fingernails and you see these white spots, on a couple of them, I've often picked them up, and people often go, oh, I've never really noticed them. Now that you point them out, I can see that they're there. And then I'll often say, well, how long have you had it for? And they'll say, oh, I've had it for years. I just thought that was normal. And then start actually focusing the questioning. And because we can do examinations, there's actually a couple of reflex points on the stomach that you can test for. And if they actually are a little bit tender on that particular side, it could also indicate a low stomach acid. So, you know, for us, there's a lot of interesting clinical tools and nutrient examinations that we can do that I find give a lot of clues. So it's interesting that you mentioned that as well. So, I mean, what are the things that can actually help improve stomach acid?
Stomach acid, I tend to start with something like apple cider vinegar that I have people take before they have their meals, especially meals that are high in protein. And that will often help digestion. If that doesn't work, you can move on to something like a betaine HCL. But I always start with food first. And when I practice, you know, we do the elimination diet, and then we focus on a lot of functional foods. So apple cider vinegar would be one of them. Fermented foods, you know, to add more probiotics into their system. The prebiotic fiber is really important. Obviously, some people can't tolerate that initially, and that would be cases where there is SIBO present potentially. But, you know, if you can, getting those prebiotic vegetables, it's very helpful in this case.
And do you recommend the apple cider with every meal that they have with protein, or is it just once a day?
I usually recommend that they put one or two teaspoons into water. You want to drink it with a straw because it can erode your teeth enamel. And then you take it maybe 15 minutes before a meal with protein, especially.
I found definitely that's my problem, because I used to take a thyroid supplement that had some zinc in it, and the zinc made me so nauseous in the morning. And so if I take it with apple cider vinegar now, it completely removes that problem of nausea, because I guess I'm absorbing it better.
That's actually a really good bedside test to say, oh, when you take zinc, do you get nauseated? That's sort of like another clue as to whether.
And there are supplements out there now. So some of my clients said, oh, I don't want to do this, but I did find a supplement. Can I take that? And I'm like, yes, you know, if that works for you, then you try the supplement. And it works really well for some people.
But also finding that if we take time to eat food, like some of the lifestyle factors as well, like if we're eating under stress and we're really not being able to chew our food enough times to stimulate the digestive process, that's also, you know, if you do it once in a while, it's probably okay, but you consistently do that, then that becomes a problem. And zinc is quite important too as a mineral because it also is involved in producing stomach acid and making and protecting our mucus lining. So it becomes an additional vicious cycle, which can exacerbate gut health and thyroid health as well.
I find zinc really sneaky because people with zinc deficiency also have a loss of taste sometimes. Mm-hmm. And so they're not as interested in their food, so they eat less and then they become more zinc deficient.
Yeah.
They have less stomach acid, they're absorbing everything else not as well. Then the B12 becomes an issue and then they get more SIBO because they don't have stomach acid. I mean, it's just a whole massive chain of events that happens with zinc. And the only thing I would say with zinc is some people just supplement with very high doses of zinc without paying attention to the copper balance. And even though copper sounds bad, you know, people think it's an inflammatory mineral, it's actually really important in a lot of the enzymatic processes. And so you do want to make sure either you test or you eat natural foods that are high in zinc and copper at the same time to make sure you're not overdoing.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And so that's kind of, you know, that's kind of the framework how I work with clients. It's the 5R, lots of functional foods, targeted supplementation, not over supplementation, but one or two targeted supplements. And then I usually throw in one or two lifestyle changes. Now, obviously I'm a nutritionist, so that's not my wheelhouse, but it can make such a big difference. And I do a lot of research in circadian rhythm. So often I start with that one because it can change someone's life if they get their circadian rhythm working again and can sleep through the night.
I think it's very interesting because we have this interesting sort of these different circadian clocks, and I'm a big fan of that because I believe that our human genetics and the different types of genes that are switched on at the different times of day and different seasons and based on the food and environment that we eat. So timing of eating and timing of things is very important. So obviously most people these days are night owls because the entire world, now we have electricity at any time of the day. And so we're up all the time, even though for some people sleeping early is actually really important for their nervous system and for the immune system. Because we know that the immune system undergoes repair at nighttime. So this is a physiological mechanism that our bodies have. So if we've got autoimmune conditions, it's overactive. How do we bring back that tolerance and how do we get that regulation back? Is that a lot of that occurs at nighttime when we're actually in deep sleep and deep repair mode. So yeah, I love that, you know, that's one of the things that I ask as well is like, how much are you sleeping? And how deep are you sleeping? So is your body really getting that repair that's needed? So yeah, the timing of food, if you're having a really heavy meal, it could be very disruptive to sleep and you don't really know unless you track it these days. There's so many sleep apps. So there's definitely a lot of things that we can do, even though, you know, we may still have our own specialty, but I think lifestyle advice is important regardless of which area that you work in. Yeah. Great.
And it's also important the timing of when you don't eat, especially for your gut health, because at night when you have a longer period of not eating and fasting, your gut has these little finger-like structures that sweep things along, so they have to do house cleaning. And so getting out all that rubbish and dirt and dead bacteria and the stomach lining, which changes once every week. So you have a lot of dead cells that you need to push out. And if you're constantly eating into the night, late night snacks, waking up in the middle of the night, going and raiding the fridge, you're not allowing the body to clean up the rubbish. And so it starts to pile up and then it creates problems because, you know, who wants a dirty house, right? You want the house to be cleaned up every night. And that's part of the problem why some people have recurrent like IBS symptoms, like you mentioned SIBO, which is small intestinal bacteria overgrowth, or the food's not moving in the right direction. So sometimes things sort of backtrack and the bacteria comes back up. So it's important to do that as well. And I think how people eat is also important. You know, a lot of people eat running around, catching the bus, eating on the go, eating with the screen on, watching TV, dinners. So all these things distract you from the eating. And people think, well, it's just more efficient, but it's actually less efficient for your body when they receive food in a state that it's not well prepared to do so, because you need to be in a very rested parasympathetic state in order for your digestive juices to flow, your stomach acid to start pumping, for you to really eat the food, extract the nutrients, turn on the good genes whilst you're doing it, and really benefit from the food. It's not just what you put into your mouth. It's also how you chew it, how your mind perceives it. You're more likely to feel sated, so you don't overeat. I mean, all these things come into play. So even if you were to just focus on lifestyle changes relating to diet, I think
you've got a lot on your mind. I had a question for both of you. Obviously, everything we're talking about right now is kind of stopping that autoimmune attack, right, and restoring tolerance. But I do think that there is some interesting research coming out that's suggesting that maybe peptides could help with restoring the thyroid after it's been attacked for many, many years. Are you using peptides in your practice to help with this?
Yeah, so basically there are two kinds of peptides that I use. So one of the peptides, particularly because we're on the topic of gut health and restoring gut tolerance, is body protection compound, which is actually produced from gastric juice. And it's a component of gastric juice that actually helps the repair mechanism of the gut. And it has a lot of good animal studies and also looking at ulcerations of the gut and repairing that. So it actually is a signaling molecule. That's what peptides do. So they signal a lot of different healing properties and enzyme functions. So that's one thing that I will, I mean, it's peptides for me, it's kind of the cherry on top. So I like to see people do all the things of elimination and doing all the lifestyle factors. And it's often then that they get a lot of bang out of the buck with peptides. But the other peptide that's very interesting and has actually been done in cancer research is the thymusin peptides. So these are peptides that are thymus gland. So we're not talking about thyroid now, we're talking about thymus. So I always have to like explain the two, because thymus and thyroid kind of sound the same.
And they're in the same area as well. So
yeah, so they're in the same area. So the thymus sits below your thyroid, and it's basically in the middle of your sternum. And it actually shrinks from the age of 30. So what happens then is that if you think about our immune system having to go through schooling to become very specific in what it does, the thymus gland is actually the school for the immune system. So we don't get that schooling as we get older. So the immune system starts to get confused, or it's slower and it doesn't operate as it should. So one of the things that is being tested or investigated is using thymus peptides in all kinds of immune-related conditions, and cancer being one of them. But also any kind of situation where the tolerance and the regulation of the system is actually not really quite there. So there has been definitely, even for what you mentioned before, actually having viruses that trigger the autoimmune condition, sometimes that can really be very helpful in helping that particular patient regulate their immune system. So it's no longer just attacking, but it's actually now clearing up the area that's undergoing inflammation. Because sometimes what I also see with autoimmune disease is that the infection may have disappeared or gone, but the signal for the immune system to stop attacking and clearing out a lot of the dead material and debris doesn't get sent. So it's this shift in the immune mechanism that's stuck in some people. And so the thymus peptides actually have quite a powerful specific role in that area. So yes, definitely the improvement in people with symptoms in that area. So it's quite a fascinating
That's really interesting.
Time to be in and using peptides.
Yeah. And actually with the thymus, I like to tie it all back together to the Dutch workshop, because what we learned at the Dutch workshop is when you have a cortisol spike in the morning, first thing when you wake up, called the cortisol awakening response, helps the thymus make sure that the immune cells that are not so functional gets taken out of the system, so they don't keep recirculating and creating more problems for the rest of the body. So getting that circadian rhythm in, making sure when you wake up that you do things to make sure you have that cortisol spike within 30 minutes of waking up, is also another really important way to make sure your immune system's functioning well. And sometimes I see it with patients with Hashimoto's, is that they flatline their cortisol awakening response. And I say, look, this is one thing that is free that you can do to make sure you improve your immune response. You can take all the supplements in the world, it's not going to help your cortisol.
So when patients come to see you, Amy, like what do they expect? Do they do a first consultation with you and then you assess their situation? And do you then give them a plan? What's the sort of like flow?
So normally I ask them to fill out an intake form and a food diary before we see each other. I have a virtual practice. So I usually get that information a couple of days before the appointment. And then we have a 1-hour consultation where we go through their full history. And based on that, I put together a personalized plan. And once they have the plan, we have another call just to make sure they've understood everything, how it works, and take it from there.
And do you check in with them regularly to see how
they're doing? Yeah, it really depends. Normally, they will start, if they're doing an elimination diet, they'll do the elimination diet first, and then we'll have our first check-in after that. And I teach them how to reintroduce the foods. Of course, along the way, if they have questions, they can always contact me. But often I find that, you know, the next appointment that we have is after they've done the elimination diet.
So where would people find you?
So you can reach me through LinkedIn. I'm Amy Lamott on LinkedIn. I have my website under construction, which will be coming soon. That's also amylamott.com. And I post a lot on Instagram, a lot of educational information. And I'm also Amy Lamott on Instagram.
Great. So people know where
thanks
to
so
find
much
you.
For having me. Thanks you so guys are pioneers in the functional medicine world, especially in Hong Kong. So it's been so great to get to know you better and learn from you.
And it's always great to work with you as well. So I really appreciate the help.
And also, I just wanted to quickly ask, we did cover a lot on autoimmune, but I know that, you know, your interest also lies in other areas as well. So is there any particular other area apart from autoimmune conditions that you're interested in or that, you know, people can
So relatively recently, I was asked to be a clinical advisor of a company out of Oxford called Oxford Healthspan. And they are trying to bring some of the scientists' research from Oxford to the market. And their first supplement is a spermidine supplement. And most people have probably never heard of spermidine before, but it is a polyamine that we actually make endogenously, that if you have the right gut bacteria, they can make some for you and that you get some from food. And the research in animals has shown that it extends lifespan and has a very important role in inducing autophagy. So this is an area that I'm doing a lot of research in currently because of my relationship with Oxford Healthspan. And I'm actually very interested in the relationship between polyamines and autoimmune conditions because there's an interesting connection there. So that's something that I'm working on right now and will continue to research in the future.
Great. That'll be interesting to see what you find.
Yeah, we'll get you back on at some point.
Yeah. So,
all right. So thank
thanks,
you, everyone.
Bye.
See you next time.
See you next time.
You can find us at anantawellbeing.com and follow us at anantawellbeing on Facebook and Instagram. If you like our podcast, please give us a 5-star review to help other like-minded people find us.
This podcast is for information purposes only. Statements and views expressed in this podcast are not medical advice and is not intended to treat or diagnose any medical condition. This podcast and its producers disclaim any responsibility for adverse effects that result from the use of this information. Opinions of guests are their own and are not endorsed by this podcast. No guarantee is given regarding the accuracy of any statements or opinions. We do not make any representation or warranties about guest qualifications or credibility. Both producers and guests may have direct or indirect interest in the products and services mentioned. If you think you have a medical condition, please consult a licensed physician.